Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Joining me today to share the 10 best spiritual books that inspired him the most on his life journey is international teacher, mystic, author, and founder of the Infinite Being website, Owen Waters, whose first book, published in 2005, popularized the term The Shift to describe the revolution in consciousness that's been driving the birth of a new paradigm since the 1960s. Owen Waters, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sandy. It's great to be here.
Owen, as someone who's dedicated his life to solving metaphysical mysteries, I'm sure that reading has played a pivotal role in your quest for that clarity. So of all the books that you've read, what was your criteria for selecting the 10 that made it to this list?
Oh, it was not easy. I looked at a lot of books just lately and picked those out as having significance. Well, let's see, you know, Spiral Dynamics made the book The Shift possible, but I should tell you something about the term The Shift. Back in 2005, when I'd written the book, it was an unknown term. The only thing I could find out about shift was it was a style of woman's dress that apparently hangs from the shoulders or something, and nobody was using the term, but I heard, either heard or read, one of the students at the Monroe Institute, where they do out-of-body training, and he went on a trip to the future, and he was supposed to tell us how the future sees us in their past, and of course, there'd been a major change, and he said they call it the shift, and I thought, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I thought, well, let's use that. And today it's very common in terms of the revolution in human consciousness.
Yeah. But the 10 books that you've picked, I mean, these, I'm assuming that you've picked because they either made a massive impact on you, or you think the quality of the information is, you know, so useful for any would-be readers.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's top priority. Really useful information. Helps anyone who's looking to advance their consciousness in any way. Highly recommended those 10.
Yeah. Well, let's start with your first book, which is Mass Dreams of the Future, which I've never heard of, I'm sorry to say, by Chet Snow. And this was published in 1989, I think.
I think the original was more like 1980. Oh, no, I had the work ended in the early 80s. That's right. First printed in 89. Yes.
Yeah. So what was it about this book that inspired you?
I always love predictions, and that's what this was. It was a collection of people's progressions into the future and then looking for common factors. And the funny thing was they had hundreds of students, and they wanted to find out in the era 2100 to 2300, if they were incarnate, what kind of world they lived in and what the world was like. And they had these very different things. The one you might expect is kind of a new agey, living in nature, green. If it was high tech, the tech was hidden and made compatible with nature. So you've got that kind of person reporting that in their future. And then you've got space dwellers, people on spaceships or other planets, that kind of thing. You'd expect that too with technical progress. And then there was an oddly common one where some people were in these dome cities on some planet that wasn't even, the air wasn't good to breathe. And there have been some terraforming going on apparently because the environment was made friendly and eventually they were able to live outside of the domes and start farming and things. So the fascinating different futures. I just like all that prediction stuff.
but was this, was this, can you put all these diverse ideas that people have down to different time frames, different planets, or different imaginations?
I wouldn't put it down to imagination so much. I think their data was quite valid. This is, remote viewing does that popularly these days, looks at different times and places, past, present, and future.
Could it also be that people are seeing potentials?
Oh, certainly, yeah. And of course, timelines change, but this is what they saw in the early 1980s. And I think at the time that we were facing the possibility of some severe Earth changes, which seemed to evaporate as the global mindset evolved during that time. And since then, we've certainly not had the kind of things that people imagine, enormous earthquakes and tsunamis and I don't know what.
Yeah, it would be interesting to take the same people back and say, well, let's do it again and see what you see. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
So book number two is a popular book. Lots of people have read this book and lots of people have chosen it as one of their 10 best. It is Journey of Souls, Case Studies of Life Between Lives by Michael Newton. 1994 that was published.
Yes, that was probably the most informative book following the original revolution of interest in near-death experiences, Raymond Moody's Life After Life book. And because he uncovered so much stuff about soul families, even the numbers you'd expect, your immediate soul group is probably 8 people. Of which some will be incarnate, some living in the spirit realms. And of course, they also have their soul aspect, which is a higher realm again than the spirit realms. But I think the total number of people in a soul family, you could expect of hundreds, maybe even 2,000 people in your extended soul family. So people travel in huge soul groups and tend to agree on similar themes in the incarnations they plan. So that was very interesting, the kind of information that came through there.
His work has been, absolutely pivotal, hasn't it? I mean, and so many people have trained with him. Very, very interesting. Book number three. Far Journeys by Robert Munro, published in 1985.
There's a classic. This was his second book. The first book was intended to get people used to the astral travel out of body idea, and he seemed sort of carefully tiptoeing through the subject. Now, this book, his second, got into some really good deep stuff. He even touched on what was obviously his entry into life on Earth. He was one of a group of fifth density galactic explorers that were on a tour group, and they came to this part of this galaxy and were looking at third density life and actually finding it a bit boring. They'd seen the boulders on and deserts on Mars. They'd seen the pock marks on the moon, and then they came to Earth. And the guide showed them, oh, and this is what they call New York, and one of the travelers said, doesn't look too new to me. It was kind of entertaining the way he told the story. But the interesting point was that this is typical of human experience in the universe that people typically operate in the soul realm, fifth density, and this is what they call the time-space illusion. When you go into reincarnation cycles, you go into the spirit realms and maybe the physical realm and loop around. And we agree on entry to life on planet Earth that time exists, space exists, but apparently they're just considered at a higher level the time-space illusion. So he talked about the fact that he was impressed with the mental band noise above New York City. You can imagine they're not consciously telepathic, so they broadcast mental noise like crazy. And he just thought it was a fascinating place and wanted to go incarnate and found the entry station with his friend following, trying not to lose him.
Wow, that sounds so incredibly, you know, far-fetched, doesn't it? I mean, and it also raises so many questions. I mean, you know, your written explanation, you know, you were saying just that about the revealing life from the perspective of soul realm galactic explorers who visit Earth as tourists, examining our reincarnation cycle of living. So that presupposes that they don't engage in reincarnation. So what, they stay alive or they die? And what happens then?
Oh, yeah, the soul body is immortal. It's made of mental energy. It's not even an etheric, let alone physical.
So these soul realm galactic explorers, they don't have to reincarnate because they never ever.
Well, yeah, this particular group was not of the type that have chosen reincarnation. And actually, from material I read, they say that choosing incarnation gets your soul to advance a whole lot faster than not. You know, they're pretty much in fifth density. These guys are pretty much playing games and being tourists, you know, whereas we're going through some, you know, severe dramas and all sorts of things that teach you things that you wouldn't know about in another level.
Has anyone in your knowledge connected with Monroe since he passed over and asked him, you know, what's he doing now?
I haven't been aware of anyone doing that. I do know that as Monroe got older, the friend that followed him and tried to keep up with him when he incarnated did incarnate as well and ended up being his wife in the last part of his life. And when she died, he just found it too sorrowful to go out of body and meet with her. It was very sad, really. So he quit out of body experiences in the final years of his life. And of course, he's still, we're training people at the Monroe Institute, and there were some very interesting experiences there.
What a legacy he left.
Yeah. And of course, his hemisync, you know, the hemispherical synchronization took off. You know, people copied it like crazy. You can buy a CD that puts you in theta deep meditation with headphones.
Yes.
You know how it works. The two different frequencies and the difference between the two resonates your brain at 8 hertz or whatever.
Yeah. Very successful. So book number 4 is a very popular book, The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe by Lynn McTaggart, and that was published in 2003.
Yeah. The thing I loved about it the most was the title. It was the perfect title for what used to be called the ether, and you've probably heard me say that one of the problems today is that the ether and etheric energy sound like the same thing, but they're actually like chalk and cheese, or like electricity and magnetism. They're very different things. The field is the fabric of space. It's really a subtle magnetic energy. If you concentrate it enough in a big planetary body, it's strong enough to be gravity. So it's that kind of subtlety, not the sort of magnetism you get concentrated around a bar magnet. That's a whole different density of magnetism. And etheric energy is like healing energy or chi. So that's one of the energies that flows through the field, the medium. So you've got the energies like electric energy, etheric energy, even mental energy that flow through the field. They used to say back in the old days before the ether was so-called disproved for a century or so that if waves wave on the ocean, and if sound or sound waves through the air, then what's the medium that carries light? And of course they believed it was the ether, actually, correctly. And then an experiment occurred where they made assumptions that were invalid and said, oh no, it doesn't seem to work. So since then we've had I guess space-time or something, which is a concept that filled the gap for a while. And now a gentleman called Professor Peter Higgs in the UK is now renowned for having proved what used to be called the ether. He first of all at CERN, the lab in Switzerland, they proved that the Higgs particle existed, and because of that it proves that the Higgs field exists. So that's the new name technically, but I think the field is what we should all be saying.
Yeah, she was right on target. And I mean, that book just opened up so many people. I remember somebody asking to borrow it, and they liked it so much they never gave the book back to me.
Yeah. I was going to say,
they didn't believe a word of what I told them about the book before they read it. And afterwards, no, you can't have this book back.
Yeah. They even had, you know, examples of mental energy passing through the field in the book. And, you know, it's interesting. They, what do they call it? The delayed choice experiment. Is that the one? That's the one that proves you can change the past. the non-locality is what they refer to. They have two particles, photons usually, that are related, and one goes off somewhere, to hit the sun or something, and the other one will react. The other one that's still in the chamber, that's kind of the cousin to the one they sent off, will react. But they found that the reaction time was nothing like light speed. It was, they thought it was instantaneous. And I think the truth is that mental energy in free space travels at millions of times light speed. So really, it wasn't actually instantaneous, but just a whole lot faster energy in its passage through the field. So that's a whole interesting new avenue as well.
Well, what was the other one you talked about? The experiment that proves that you can change
your path. Yeah, that's leading edge stuff, isn't it? Apparently you can. If we're in the time-space illusion, to quote Monroe, well, it shouldn't be a big surprise. It's just that your mind is conditioned to that being impossible. If it happened, it's fixed. I think it's because of timelines. You know, they say if someone could have gone back into the past the grandfather paradox, that's what they call it. If they'd gone back and murdered their grandfather, then they couldn't have done that because they wouldn't have been born. So that's the paradox. And apparently, if you tried it, all that would happen would be a new timeline opens up. So you'd have two timelines instead of the original one, where other things happened with a different past in the new timeline. All pretty complicated. But the in the physics lab, they've got this delayed choice experiment where a decision is made, and the only way it could have happened is if the particle knew what happened in its past. I forget the details now, but it's very interesting in principle. I mean, the concept is scary because changing your past is one of those taboo things, isn't it, still?
Well, I'm sure it's something we've all thought about, and wished we had the ability to do that.
Yeah. I've been told by a reliable source that people often do run parallel timelines, even of their own life. And then it's a soul curiosity thing. They don't just happen at every decision point. Mm. Some scientists say, well, what if every decision creates two timelines and then you have an infinite number of gazillions? Well, who's going to support the energy? That your soul creates timeline experiences. The idea is we live in a dream created by the soul. Well, the soul's doing the work, and the soul has to be interested in what would have happened along that timeline to create a parallel. And typically, when you come to nodal points in world affairs, like World War II was an example of one big nodal point where pretty much everybody in all timelines on Earth went through that experience in some version or other. It was considered important in the evolution of humanity. So you've got to figure out that the soul is going to probably close down uninteresting timelines and just merge them in and add energy to the ones that you're in or the one that you're in, especially when we get near to the ascension point, which is probably just a few short at this point, which would be the climactic event of the shift, and why these guys from the future say, oh, yes, before the shift, well, what was the big event? So far, we've had decades of changes, radical changes since the 1960s.
And so you said about World War II, I mean, everybody experiencing that, then that means that pretty much everybody was choosing the same timeline, the same choice to be able to converge and all experience that. But, so how is everybody choosing the same? Is this a collective consciousness decision?
Well, that does come into it, doesn't it? There's a global mind atmosphere that encompasses the whole world that all of humanity shares. We're not consciously telepathic, but unconsciously we receive and transmit into this mental atmosphere. Of course, it's also been called the noosphere. That's another word for it. And that's where a lot of collective efforts go. I find it strange-sided to have this COVID calamity that affected everyone, but it's like that with big events like wars and stuff.
Well, if there's a purpose to it, then why not? The thing is that people are not decided on the purpose. Many people have several purposes for it. But let's move on to book five, which is an interesting one, The Prism of Lyra: An Exploration of Human Galactic Heritage by Lissa Royal, published again in 1989. What a great year that was for books.
Must have been. that was a lot of changes I was going through then. Okay, so it's a reliable sources, and a reliable channel. Lissa Royal is very particular about quality. She's not someone who would bring through an entity that's misleading, which of course can happen in the channeling world more than you might think. You could have a perfectly honest channel being misled by a source. And if they say things like, everything's going to be fixed for you by the beings of light, just sit back in your armchair and wait while we do that. Well, that's false information. It's intended to disempower light workers. Instead of doing things that'll help improve the world. So her sources are two future versions of herself. So this is something I've seen more than once. Usually she channels a Pleiadian who's from 300 years ahead of where we are and time travels back to work with Lisa. And another one is from further in the future, who's a fifth density being. She becomes fifth density, obviously, after 300 years from now. And so the fifth density entity has a wider view of reality than the fourth density Pleiadian, which is pretty interesting. So the source and the channel are pretty impeccable. And she put together this book, The Prism of Lyra, which described how humans were first formed in the Lyra constellation, or I guess Lyra is what they say in British English. But it started with Lyrans and then branched out. There was something called the Apex Planet, where they investigated physical existence. The original Lyrans were pretty much fifth density, and they became what we called, or what were called, the Founders. The Founders being the ones who would design human forms, you know, the DNA and everything, to live in different environments. And then later they went on to, some of the Lyrans came to Earth eventually, and they used to sample DNA from primates and incorporate it into themselves so that they could better fit the Earth environment, temperatures, gravity, so the time cycle, that kind of thing. And they later left Earth and moved off and founded their home in the Pleiades. So that's where they were. Also, in the Sirius star system, which is just 7 light years from here, as opposed to 500 for the Pleiades, a lot of different groups were founded in the Sirius system. And there's a whole lot of drama through history that the book goes into, where when you sink into third density physicality, you tend to lose your connection to, you know, your divine source, and arguments break out and all kinds of things. 3D is kind of a contentious zone compared to four. Fourth density is heart-centered. So, you know, people live in 3D in their physical life, and then when they pass on, they go into four in spirit realms. And that's where they kind of repair the damage they did in three, to put it bluntly, you know, in a lot of cases. So the book really goes into the dramas that happened. There was a case of the Orion culture, which got really massively controlling of the people there. It was almost a catastrophe, and eventually they transformed into the light, but through great difficulty. So I do recommend that if you're looking for history of humanity, that you'll see a lot of stories out there, and this is just a great source, I believe, a reliable one.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to a No BS Spiritual Book Club interview and sharing the 10 books that had the biggest influence on his life journey. Today is lifelong mystic, teacher, author, and founder of the Infinite Being website, Owen Borters, who's dedicated his life to solving metaphysical mysteries. We'll be back with more from Owen Borters after this break.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. And when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion. And there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com. Click on the Work With Me tab and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself. Invest in your brand. And then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Own Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Own Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Own Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Own Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Own Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Owen Waters, book number 6 is by somebody who is very well known to our audience. The book is The Elves of Lily Hill Farm, A Partnership with Nature, and it's by Penny Kelly, who's very popular these days. And the book was published in 1997.
Okay, you're looking for my input. Yeah, it's vital that people understand this aspect of the new type of agriculture we need. To work with the devas or nature spirits is really vital. I mean, they're there and they're responsible for making the plants grow. They're part of creation. They don't have the free will type of experience that humans do. They can get mischievous, but not. They're primarily assigned to looking after certain plants or elements. You know, that you can have a spirit of the water, of a lake, even of a mountain. They're scary big, those. I was told once you should ask permission of the diva of the mountain before ascending and going on a hike, and mm-hmm. which I did, and the mental response was kind of booming and rather large. So, but we need to, even though we can't normally see these nature spirits, they're there, and if we're at least sensitive to feelings or thoughts that come from them, they can read our thoughts perfectly, you know. So the communication in one direction is good. But if we're sensitive to, you know, these things, then we can make the right decisions. They can certainly guide us into doing all sorts of things to help produce better crops in a more balanced environment. I did make a note of one experience I had with nature spirits. It was in 1998, and this book reminded me of it, when my wife and I were visiting England to look at the latest batch of crop circles. And we stayed in a hotel and looked out around the back, and there were some woods there which just felt enchanted, and that's a sign that nature spirits live there, you know, a group of them. And yet it was really close to the hotel, so it's like the hotel had been dumped and built right there next to their woodlands, which, you know, they probably weren't too happy about simply because of the human activity nearby. And anyway, the next morning, my wife said, they were up here in our room last night. They came to visit. And I thought, oh, they must think we may be of use to them somehow. They probably registered that we were concerned when we were near their woods before. Mm-hmm. So we went back out to the little woodland out the back of the hotel. And, I know what happened. First, I got my local map. Being ready for crop circles, I had a detailed map of the area, and sure enough, within a mile or two, there was a huge private woodland area that they could use instead of the populated hotel grounds. So we mentally suggested that if they wanted to follow us or representatives of them, we'd show them how to get to that woodland area that they may prefer. And so, which we did, we showed them how to get there. And a couple of years later, we came back, not a sign of nature spirits behind the hotel. So of course we headed over to the woodlands and there was a whole bunch of them jumping, or like they do, you know, they're kind of excitable. So I guess their old friends were back, but
yeah, there are places where you can feel them.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. The enchanted feeling.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The woods at Damanhur is one of those places where I definitely felt, you know, their energy. Yeah. And I think this is the book where Penny reveals that, you know, she was producing grape juice or something for Del Monte, I think.
Yeah,
and
the elf told her,
they told her how to increase her yield naturally. Phenomenal level.
Yeah, record-breaking crops. And this was from vines that were in bad shape when she bought the farm.
Yeah. Well, you know, we only have the Findhorn story to know what can happen. So let's move on to book number 7, which is Power Versus Force, The Hidden Determinants in Human Behavior by David Hawkins, published in 2002.
Yes, he discovered kinesiology, muscle testing, which allows you to get yes-no responses from your unconscious mind. So if you're in a store and you pick up a vitamin bottle and hold it in your left hand, you could, you know, push down on your hand with the other hand and test the strength. Yeah. And what you're looking for is a strong response, meaning yes, is this good for me? Yeah. Strong response, yes. Or if your hand just flops down weakly, that's a no. So he developed this idea of kinesiology to do all sorts of things. He started looking at the different levels of human consciousness, from suicidal depression all the way up to the top of the Maslow hierarchy, and started calibrating everything. And he decided to start from zero and go up to maybe 1,000. But what he found along the way was that the scale wasn't linear. It didn't go in a straight line. If you were like twice the reading of where you were, the power of your consciousness there wasn't twice. It was linear. It was like four times. Excuse me. So then he mapped the whole human consciousness scale, and he found that you need a level of 200 in the global mind for the human race to survive. And you know, until the 1980s, it was actually a bit below there. So again, the 80s were an interesting time of change. And then he found that if people engage in higher activity, you know, mental, then go on up to spiritual 500. But the thing is that if you're engaged in spiritual activity, like meditation, for example, you're compensating in the mind belt for 750,000 people who are below the 200 level. This is the exponential scale. It's like I said, it's not linear, it's logarithmic or exponential. A huge amount of effect. So you can see how light workers really fit in. You just by being here, you know, just being and thinking in the mind belt, you're compensating for just billions of people, you know, in unfortunate situations.
Well, many, many people swear by David Hawkins' books, don't they?
Yeah, he's passed on now, unfortunately, but...
Yes.
Yeah, a huge amount of work he did, just enormous.
Yeah. So book number 8 is The Ultimate Time Machine, A Remote Viewer's Perception of Time and Predictions for the New Millennium by Joseph McMonagall, 1998. And of course, he was probably the best remote viewer that I think the CIA had in their remote viewing experiments.
Yeah, he was in a pioneer group with the U.S. Army. Forgotten the name of it now. Yeah, they started playing with remote viewing because they knew the Soviets were doing it and psychic things. And so they thought, well, we'd better catch up and see what happens. And so he just spent, I think, 17 years with Stargate. I think that was the name of the project, where they were transferring their mind to locations, you know, like Russian nuclear missile sites and things. Excuse me. You're talking too much here. he would do that and report back information that the Army hoped they could use, the CIA hoped they could use.
Yeah.
There, with the veritable frog in the throat.
If you want to take a minute, I'll just read, give you our voice a little rest. I'll just read what you said. You said
in the book, yes, please.
He sheds light on the nature of time, on how we can change our past as well as our future, how we often slip between alternate timelines, and he delivers a detailed picture of our immediate future through the year 2075 with specifics on population, aging, religious fragmentation, lifestyle changes, technological developments, and positive changes to customs and culture. And he even presents an encouraging remote viewed vision of life in the year 3000. Well, I think, you know, we would all like to have his view of the future. But as you've said, that, you know, things can change over time. And what one sees at one point, you know, there's a lot of people involved in making a lot of decisions that can change that.
Yeah, what he saw in the year, what he saw in the year 3000 was ecologically brilliant. It was typically a city, a small city near a flowing river that would bring water in and then help with, after they processed what came out. And he noticed that these cities, while interconnected to smaller local communities, they all seemed to be away from the coastline. So at some point they learned living on the coast is not a great idea long term over the centuries. But they had, you know, the whole process. I mean, recycling was built into everything. There was no waste like there is today. Very interesting.
So book number 9 is Spiral Dynamics. You mentioned this earlier. Mastering Values, Leadership and Change by Don Beck and Christopher Cowan, published in 2005. What was it about this book that intrigued you so much?
Well, they introduce the idea of memes, which are like genes, as in, but mental. They're patterns of thought that start and then spread I think probably through the mind belt, or, you know, the noosphere. So they documented a set of 6 and then 2 more, which presumably were the first 2 in another set of 6, but they didn't know beyond that. And that intrigued me that there would be a total of 12 of these stages of human evolution. You know, we're talking start from basic survival in stage 1 to into stage 6, where people start getting heart aware. You see a lot of heart-centered consciousness today. And then stage 7 is what he called a quantum leap into a new set of, or a new tier of memes. And this was where you turn into active heart-centered consciousness rather than passive. In the stage six, so you're getting used to heart-centered awareness. Stage seven, you're taking action and changing the world one way or another. And so I picked up on the idea that there must be 12 total memes, even though four are unknown. And then I thought about the chakras, because they seem to correlate perfectly with what they were finding. You know, the one thing a lot of people don't realize is there are two faces to many of the chakras. There's a forward face and a backward face leading out of the back of the spine. So you've got the crown chakra at the top, the root chakra at the bottom. Those are singular, but the other five face in two directions. And what I realized was that like the front-facing heart chakra is the lower version of heart consciousness, the passive getting used to heart consciousness stage. And the rear-facing one is a slightly higher frequency. That's the active heart chakra. And so if you take five double faces, that's 10 plus the other two, you have 12 chakra faces. And all of a sudden, things were starting to look interesting. So then I turned to the piano keyboard, which I haven't turned to since my teenage years, and noticed that in the C octave, and there's certain people seem to agree that middle C resonated with the root chakra. That was a good place to start. In the C octave, even though you have seven major keys, just like they say you have seven major chakras, you actually have a total of 12 major and minor keys in the octave. And so each one going up a half tone before it. So this is how it works with the chakras. The face of the heart chakra goes, if you go up a half tone, you're in the rear face, the active heart-centered consciousness. So that I put all this together in the as a discovery as to what the whole memes thing was leading to, and therefore what the future of humanity is. And of course, stage 12, we're talking the ultimate stage of yoga, you know, full enlightenment, nirvana.
We're going to have to speed it up a little bit now, Owen, because we've really only got about 8 minutes left. Let's talk about your 10th book, The Revival, Path to a New Earth, New Human by Penny Kelly. Penny has been on our other shows talking about this quite a lot lately, and it is a terrific book. And I know that you agree.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Yeah, it is perfect. In fact, it's showing a side of Penny that's kind of like her potential that nobody was really aware of yet, but she's got this wide vision of what's needed in all these different aspects of human endeavor, you know, the education, energy, food, health, and, you know, the free trade system where individuals are empowered. And really today they tend not to be. We live in a world that's kind to large corporations and not so to the little guy, typically. And that needs to change if we're going to really...
And there are many initiatives afoot. You know, the regenerative farming, there's some wonderful organizations that are working with small farmers and making sure that they don't get pushed out by the big organizations. I think this book, I love all of Penny's book, but this one is so perfect for our time. And it does offer us, you know, wonderful visions and very practical, doable visions for how we can change the paradigm. Well, that's your
she's
10
been
books.
On interviews. Go ahead.
I was going to say, because we don't have much time, I really do want to ask a couple of questions of you. That is your 10 best list, and now it's time to talk about you, and we've only got about 5 minutes. In 2007, an ascended master entrusted you to spread the answer to what had been the greatest spiritual mystery of all time, the reason why the universe was created. So, tell us what that reason was.
Oh, in one word, the first seed of action is how it was presented, was curiosity. It was curiosity as to what would happen if it, the oneness, could see itself from different angles, even an infinite number of different perspectives. That was it. Curiosity started the great silent oneness into becoming a creator aspect and doing everything that involves action.
Isn't the universe. Makes me think of the saying, curiosity killed the cat.
Maybe, yeah, it's been a risky run.
It has been a risky. Yeah, I wonder whether the great consciousness, you know, the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, regrets that decision.
Oh, I don't think so. No, it's an adventure and it keeps going, you know.
Well, it is for us.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, that was, I think I was entrusted with the information because I published that first book 2 years before and was doing weekly articles to a big newsletter list. And it was obvious that I would spread the word, you know, if I was told, and I'm sure others have been told the same message. I mean, it's for thousands of years, some of the greatest Indian philosophers would agonize over this thing. Yes, well, you know, the universe was created, but if its point is to evolve back to perfection when it started with perfection, what's the point?
Yeah,
that was why it was such a big mystery.
Mm. Yeah. So what's your view, in a short number of words, what is your view of where we are heading now? It looks as though the world is in utter chaos, but we also know that chaos has to occur before, you know, new things can be generated. Are you hopeful about the future?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're in, people who study cycles say we're in a war cycles time for a couple of years. That doesn't mean we have to make a big mess out of everything. I think the big thing is that in probably, I believe, 2 years from now, we have gone through a global ascension event or a rapture where the physical matter on Earth, including our bodies, gets upgraded from third density to fourth density. And when that happens, first of all, you're in a heart-centered environment, but also your abilities will flower. You'll start getting telepathic abilities, clairvoyant abilities, all of those subtle senses will kick into action once everything physical does the big move, you know. And I believe when they referred to the shift, they were referring more to that than the decades we've been through.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, if we all hold a vision of that, then the power of the, you know, the conscious collective can make that happen. Mm-hmm. Owen Walters, thank you so much for adding your 10 best list of spiritual books to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's Library of Recommendations.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Sandy. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Owen Walters' 10 best list can be found at the nobsspiritualbookclub.com. His books include The Shift, The Revolution in Human Consciousness, The Lightworker Mission, Reconnect with Your Primary Purpose, Spiritual Metaphysics, Answers to the Great Mysteries of Life, and Spirituality Made Simple, to name just a few. For more information about his work, his books, his free articles, and his newsletter, visit infinitebeing.com. This episode of the No BS Spiritual Book Club is also available as a free downloadable podcast at On Times, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Audible, and all the major podcast platforms. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me, and thank you to Owen Walters.